This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Chapter 21 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 21. Almost immediately, Carlos heard police sirens coming from both ends of the open ring. He slowed to a walk. 20 feet ahead, a policeman emerged from the open passage and walked purposefully toward him, scanning faces in the crowd. Carlos turned around. He saw the old man with the rolled umbrella, not walking, standing and peering into the crowd. Carlos moved away from him and joined a group of sightseers clustered around a guide at the entrance to the opera house.
The present building was erected in 1778, during the last years of the reign of the Empress Maria Theresa.
The guide was a middle-aged woman, stocky in flat shoes and floppy hat, with a yellow, no-nonsense face. She told them about the opera house, and several sightseers began taking pictures of it. Watery spring sunshine glistened on the black rolles and lacus. Carlos edged deeper into the group. Standing next to him was a man in a corduroy jacket with two cameras slung around his neck. He had a small, carefully trimmed mustache, and he looked like an American. His wife was beside him, a woman with a sweet, nondescript face blinking at the sunlight through thick glasses. The man said to Carlos,
"What do you think of it?"
"Very nice,"
Carlos said.
"You don't like it?"
"I know very little about buildings."
"I know a hell of a lot about them," the man said moodily. "This one isn't worth photographing."
The guide said,
"Just one moment, ladies and gentlemen. Your attention, please."
Everyone looked up.
"I am sorry to say that several people have joined us who do not belong in the group. I must ask them if they will please move back."
Carlos stood his ground. After a moment, two men and a woman walked away.
"Thank you," the guide said. "I did this only because it is difficult for our own group to hear me when there are too many. You have paid me. You have the right to hear me. Now we will return to the bus, please. Our next stop is St. Stephen's Cathedral."
Carlos went with the group. The guide stood at the door of the bus watching the tourists file in. Hardly daring to hope, Carlos walked past her. He was among the last to board, and he saw that the bus was half empty. The guide was paying no attention to him. She had accepted a cigarette from the bus driver and was saying something to him in German.
"I guess she'll make sure we get our money's worth,"
said the man in the corduroy jacket.
"I think she will,"
Carlos said.
"What part of South America are you from?"
the man asked in good Spanish. Carlos swung around in his seat. The bus had started.
"I am from Bolivia." "Thought so," the man said. He nudged his wife. "Didn't I tell you? Bolivia or Peru? That's the accent." "Are you a language expert?"
Carlos asked.
"Hell no, I'm an engineer. Spent 3 years in South America. Learning Spanish was bad enough, but when it came to Indian dialects..."
"Very difficult,"
Carlos said. He didn't want to talk about Indian dialects. Desperately, he added,
"I have lived many years in Africa."
"Well, I'll be damned," the engineer said. "I've spent some time there myself. What part?"
Carlos could feel his mind going numb.
Zanzibar,
he said. He had worked on a ship which had put in there once.
"Never got over to East Africa," the engineer said. "What was it like?"
"Hot and dirty."
"Yeah," the engineer said sadly. "I thought it was probably like that."
He settled back in his seat. The guide was pointing out the sights they passed. Carlos watched and calculated the direction they were going. Later, he consulted the American's map, which showed the places covered on the tour. It worked out very well. He would leave them at Maria Hilf, only a few blocks from where he wanted to go. When his business was completed, he would strike out to the southeast toward Turkey. He had eluded the Soviets, the Americans, and the Austrians during the first dangerous hour. Now he had no doubt that, with proper precautions, he could elude them all indefinitely. He was beginning to feel good. He had stolen many things in his life, but this was the first time he had ever stolen a guided tour. Susan Bellows had friends throughout Europe, but none of them were in Vienna at present. Still, she knew where to go to make new friends. At the bar next to American Express, she fell into conversation with a languid, amiable American named James Blake. He was an art dealer in Europe on his annual buying trip, and he had found very little worth purchasing this time. The really good furniture had vanished years ago. The paintings were growing scarcer. There was plenty of second-rate stuff, profitable to handle, but aesthetically uninteresting. It looked as though he would have to go into Greece to make the trip at all satisfactory, and his stomach couldn't tolerate the food south of Vienna. He wasn't much, but he helped her fill the afternoon. They left the bar and strolled toward Steffenplatz. Blake pointed out the sights with the air of a man passing a 5- and 10-cent store window. He was tired of Vienna, and the American embassy had refused to grant him a visa to Budapest. "What's that?" Susan asked. "St. Stephen's, some of the best stained glass in Europe." They walked past the guided tours, which crowded around the entrance. She was depressed by the sight of all those people dipping themselves in culture in the hope that some of it would stick. Still, what else was there to do? Sightseeing was horrible, but it was what Europe was there for. One did penance to culture by walking for miles on tired feet, staring at cracked paintings hung along miles of corridors in the Prado, the Louvre, the Royal Academy. If only one could meet the people. But who the hell wanted to meet the people? The people were worse than their culture. Unstable, self-satisfied little monsters who love their Europe under glass. What do you think of our European music, art, architecture? All slightly moldy. She didn't want to meet the people. All she ever met was distorted reflections of herself. "What's the matter?" Blake asked. Susan had stopped suddenly. She had caught a glimpse of a short man with coarse black hair standing in a crowd of sightseers. Before he turned away, the edge of his profile had been familiar. "If he's a friend of yours," Blake said resignedly, "I suppose we could go up and say hello." The sightseers were entering the cathedral.
"It doesn't matter," Susan said. "Where are we going?"
"There's a pretty nice bar not far from here. By the way, are you free this evening?"
"Absolutely."
The last of the tourists had passed through the cathedral's high bronze doors. The short man went in with them. She couldn't be sure if he was the same man she had seen in London. "What about that drink?" Blake asked.
"Lead on," she said.
End of chapter 21. Chapter 22 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. LibriVox recordings in the public domain. Chapter 22.
"You're sure?"
the woman asked.
"Certainly, madam," Bardief told her.
Zetner gave a stiff little nod of agreement, and the young man with the knapsack said,
"Don't you remember now, madam? That guy definitely had a mustache."
She turned away from the three witnesses. They watched her, and the policeman in the musty station house also watched. The duty sergeant behind his tall, paper-littered desk stared at the ceiling and absent-mindedly stroked his own mustache. She had given her occupation a schoolteacher, primary grades. She prided herself on her keen powers of observation and her excellent memory. She had led her classes on numerous walks through the sparse Connecticut woods, pointing out the bobwhite and the whippoorwill unerringly. She had taken several hundred pictures of Europe on her last vacation and had been able to identify them all years later, quickly and easily. Her students liked her, only those bigots on the school board complained that she was absent-minded and eccentric, and they did that simply because she was new in town, simply because she needed 6 more months for tenure. Only 6 more months. If she was careful, if she was discreet. And here were 2 Russians and an American college boy insisting that the man had had a mustache. Their identification was wrong. If she left it uncorrected, a dangerous maniac might escape. But if she persisted against the certainties of 3 men, might not her name get into the newspapers? Would anyone hear of it in Connecticut? She had stuck to her views too often in the past, and she had had to change jobs too often. Now, although the spirit sometimes rebelled, all she wanted was peace, quiet, and tenure.
"It must have been a very small mustache,"
she said. Compromises always began in a small way.
Exactly, said the young man with the knapsack. It was a sort of hairline mustache.
That is what I would call it, Bardief said, and Zettner curtly nodded agreement. The American said,
Do you remember now, madam?
No more difficulties, she told herself.
Yes, I do remember. I'm afraid I'm a little absent-minded.
Not in the slightest, madam, the older Russian said. Memory is a tricky thing, and identification after the event is very difficult. I would not remember the mustache if the man had not been sharing our table. She nodded. She was grateful to him. He seemed like a nice man. She had always felt that the Russians were ordinary people just like the rest of us, if only you could meet them away from their rulers.
Then that's it, Bardief said to the sergeant. We all agree that the man had a mustache. He was of medium height, perhaps slightly taller than medium.
She didn't remember that at all, but it was too late to disagree.
And he spoke with a foreign accent.
Could you place the accent? The sergeant asked.
Definitely Italian, I'm sure of it, Bardief added. Because I spent some years in Italy, it's all in my statement.
Do you agree? The sergeant asked Zettner.
Yes, he was Italian.
Is there anything else you can think of?
Very well.
Madam, would you care to amend your written statement in regard to the mustache?
She changed it where the sergeant indicated, then signed it. The rest of them signed their statements.
There is an excellent chance of catching the man, the sergeant said. I can't make any promises, of course, but chances are good.
He handed the statements to a policeman.
Now, sir, he said to Bardief, please permit me to have your shoulder attended to.
Bardief smiled and shook his head.
Thank you. No, it is only a scratch.
Scratches can become infected.
I'll paint some iodine on it later.
But we would feel remiss if you didn't allow us to do this, the sergeant said. Our police surgeon is here in the building, just down the corridor. I would take it as a personal favor if you would let him look at it.
Bardief realized that the sergeant was worried about the possible effect of this incident on Russo-Austrian relations. The man should have been a diplomat. Smiling, Bardief refused.
I'll have our doctor at the embassy look at it. Don't worry, Sergeant. No possible blame can be attached to Austria or the Austrian police.
The sergeant looked grateful. Zettner had difficulty concealing his distaste for Bardief's tactics. Anything, no matter how small, should be used to increase the tensions already implicit in the bourgeois society. It was axiomatic among those who had not forgotten the real nature of the class struggle. The sergeant came down from his desk and shook hands with them all. He walked with them to the door of the station house. The young American waved cheerfully and walked toward the open ring. The schoolteacher hesitated, then went the same way. Bardief and Zettner walked in the opposite direction toward Maria Theresienplatz.
And now it's too late, Zettner said.
Perhaps not, if the others did their work properly.
Even if they did, it will make no difference. Those damn policemen. The thief is probably across the border into Switzerland by now.
That would be wisest for him, Bardief said. But thieves rarely do the wisest thing. We must count on their innate stupidity. Come, Zettner, the game is far from lost. You and I have some serious business which calls for our undivided attention.
Zettner looked into Bardief's clear, frosty blue eyes. He nodded. Yes, there was serious work to do, and no time for personal rivalries. At a time like this, united in purpose, he felt almost an affection for Bardief. It was too bad the man was being sent home next week. End of chapter 22.
Chapter 23 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. The SliverVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 23. The jukebox played Zigeuner. The bartender, Gemutschlik, in flowing fair mustache and leather apron, served two more Gibsons. On the paneled walls were frescoes showing scenes from Strauss operettas. The ashtrays were shaped like little woodsmen's cottages. Susan Bellows, with her fourth Gibson for the day clutched in her hand, looked steadily at her companion.
"Is anything wrong?" Blake asked.
"I don't like your hands."
"My hands?"
"They haven't any hair."
Blake laughed nervously and rubbed his hands together.
"Have another drink."
"Want to drink me into bed?"
"Good Lord," Blake said.
I just thought you might enjoy another drink.
He lit a cigarette in order to have something to do with his hands. Since college days, he had been taught that the quickest and surest, if not the neatest, way of bringing a young lady to bed was through the judicious administration of liquor. On the part of the administrator, this required an extremely careful regulation of one's own drinking, like tasting poison to assure the victim that the potion was perfectly safe. Without careful regulation, Blake was apt to find himself unable to perform once the desired moment had been reached. With a certain coarse type of woman, this could result in shocking language and horrifying accusations quite damaging to an already fragile ego. Blake had long ago accepted with melancholy these hazards to the cold-blooded pursuit of seduction.
"I'm having another," he said. "What about you?"
"Pour on, Macduff," Susan said. "Pour me a drink with your hairless hands."
Blake smiled, inwardly wounded. He was hairless all over. Perhaps this time it would be best not to... But Susan had suddenly clapped him on the shoulder. She was peering into his face with disconcerting green eyes half hidden by a sweep of smooth blonde hair.
"I think you're all right, Blake," she said. "You're a bloody, shocking heathen, but you broke a British square."
"Righto," Blake said, and took a tiny sip from his Gibson.
Susan had finished her fourth and started on her fifth. But she was not drunk, and decidedly not amorous. Whenever she bedded with a man, she did so cold sober, faintly amused, faintly repelled, but above all, fully conscious. She used liquor for an entirely different purpose, as an excuse to release certain hostile tendencies. Her analyst had pointed this out, but so far had not effected a change.
"Yes, Blake," she said. "I think maybe you're all right."
"Why don't you call me Jim?"
"I wouldn't call a dog Jim. Have another drink, Blake. You're filthily sober."
All hope of seduction gone, Blake swallowed half his Gibson. Then Susan was leaning over him, her warm and joyously rounded left breast pressed into his hairless right arm.
"Blake, what do you think about life?"
As casually as possible, he transferred his drink to his left hand. Hope began to flicker again.
"Life? That's a rather big order."
"Don't give me that. You're a man of arts. You ought to have an attitude on life, for Christ's sake."
"Well, of course."
She was pressing even more firmly against him. Was it possible she didn't realize it? Women sometimes didn't.
"Okay," Susan said. "Let's hear what you think about life."
"It seems to me," Blake said as lightly as he could, "that life is the avoidance of pain."
"That's what you think life is? Oh, Blake, you disappoint me."
Blake was astonished to realize that he suddenly felt like punching her in the nose. But the breast, promising pleasures unspeakable, was still against his arm, almost in the crook of his elbow.
"You know what life is?" Susan asked. "I'll tell you. Life is a runty little black-haired man scurrying across Europe. What do you think about that?"
"It's a very interesting image."
He eased his arm across the back of the booth. Centimeter by centimeter, he lowered his arm to rest upon her shoulder in carefree camaraderie.
"That's what life is," Susan said. "You know the man I saw at that big church?"
"St. Stephen's?"
"Yeah, where do you think that man is now?"
"How on earth should I know?" Blake asked.
His arm was resting on her shoulder. She was sitting close to him, thigh to thigh. The self-conscious undergraduate manual of seduction opened before his eyes.
"Use your head," Susan said. "He was with a guided tour. Where would the tour be now? I'm serious, Blake."
Blake always tried to humor a lady's whims. He concentrated.
"Let's see, that was about an hour ago. Those tours usually circle the city in 2 hours. The Opera House, the Rathaus, the Messeplatz.
I know you're an experienced traveler, Blake. Where exactly would he be?"
"Probably at the old church on Mariahilf. I believe it was built just after the first siege by the Ottoman Turks."
Susan stood up.
"Drink up, me lad."
"Susan, I really don't think..."
She bent over him and took his face in her hands.
"Blake, you don't realize it, but the fate of all Europe, nay, of all Christendom, rests in our hands. I am a lady operative disguised as a drunk. We must find that nondescript little man and send word to headquarters. If we fail, I can't answer for the consequences."
Blake paid and accompanied her. She was playing some crazy sort of game, but he knew that most games ended in bed. He hailed a cab. In 10 minutes, they were driving through the granite slums of Mariahilf to the church, squat and round like a watchtower, set back from the street and dwarfed by the huge Österreichisches Museum in front of the church. A crowd of tourists reverently read their light meters. A guide recited past glories.
"Built in 1532 to commemorate the victory of Maximilian over Suleiman and his Turkish hordes, this structure occupies a section of what was the old wall around Vienna. Please observe the slit windows."
"Blake," Susan said, "you are a genius. The organization has need of you."
Do you see him?" Blake asked.
Susan walked around the crowd, ignoring the marked displeasure of the sad-faced little guide. She stopped, and her face lost animation.
"He isn't here." "It was only a guess," Blake said. "His tour might be somewhere else."
"Of course it is. I'm a damn fool."
"Oh, well," Blake said, putting his hand lightly on her shoulder. "I'm sure..."
"Wait a minute," Susan said. Another party of tourists was coming out of the church, led by a large woman in a floppy hat. Susan gripped Blake's arm fiercely.
"He's there. That's him."
Blake nodded. He wasn't impressed by the dark little man. Susan certainly had some strange friends and some bizarre tastes.
"Do you see that?" she asked. "He's walking away. He's leaving the tour."
"I don't blame him," Blake said.
"I better not lose sight of him. Look, I'd appreciate it very much if you'd go to the nearest telephone and call Stephen Dane. Have you got that? Stephen Dane."
Now, just a minute. Dane's staying at the Excelsior Hotel. If he isn't in, U.S. Army Intelligence should be able to reach him."
"Susan,
tell him where I am. I'll be following that man, so he'll have to look around for me."
It reminded Blake of Hell Week at NYU. Phone this person, go up to that person, beg 100 pennies before dawn. He said,
Susan, I'm not going to do anything of the sort. Don't you think this joke has gone far enough?
We're wasting time. I'll lose him."
"Susan, did you hear me?"
She turned and gripped him tightly by the lapels.
"Blake, do this for me. I swear it's no joke. That man is really a criminal."
Blake looked dubious.
"If this is some sort of silly trick..."
"Thanks, Blake. Stephen Dane, Hotel Excelsior. I'll meet you tonight in the Hungary Bar, around 9.
She hurried off in the direction the dark little man had taken. Blake stood in front of the church, his hands deep in his pockets. Why did he always get mixed up with women like that? What was he going to get out of it? Tonight at the Hungary Bar. Yes, there was always hope. He could call up very casually, pretend he was in on the joke. What was the man's name again? Somebody at the Excelsior Hotel? He walked slowly away from the church. End of chapter 23.
Chapter 24 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 24. Vienna was filled with churches. This one at Mariahilf reminded Carlos of a prison. He stayed at the rear of the crowd as it came outside into the gray slate courtyard. The guide, her hat pushed back, was saying something about frescoes. The American engineer and his wife had moved to the front to hear her. Carlos looked around once quickly. People passed on the street, and a pretty blonde girl was arguing with a man. It looked all right. He was on Mariahilf, and the tour was as close as it would come to where he wanted to go. He slipped away into a side street, walking easily but prepared to run. Already he felt safer in the maze of narrow streets and courtyards. This was the kind of section in which he felt at home anywhere in the world. First, he had to visit the drunken Klaus. There was no avoiding it. But immediately after that, he and Anna would get out of Vienna. It was no place for him, this cold, dead city far from the sea. He had angered the Americans, the Soviets, and now the Austrians. The Austrians were nothing, but it was their country. The Americans might not kill him, but they would surely lock him up for a long time. The Soviets would kill him. He came to Klaus's street and walked to the third cellar door on the left. He entered quickly, stopping just inside the entrance until his eyes became accustomed to the gloom. On one side was a furnace, its peeling white arms clasping the low ceiling. On the other side, just past the coal bins, was Klaus's room. Klaus lived in it without paying rent, in return for helping the janitor.
"Klaus,"
Carlos called, standing in front of the door to his room. There was no answer. He knocked, then pushed the door open. A single window set at street level allowed a dirty gray light to filter into the room. By it, Carlos saw Klaus lying against the wall with his mouth drawn petulantly down, his eyes half closed. He looked completely drunk.
"Wake up!"
Carlos shouted. But when he bent down to shake him, he saw that a knife protruded from Klaus's neck. The knife was bone-handled and narrow in the blade, very much like the knife he had left in the Russian. This one had been driven hard into the windpipe, and Klaus's chin rested on the handle. Carlos jumped back and whirled around. He listened, but there didn't seem to be anyone else in the cellar. They had done their work and gone. He examined the room. It had been quickly and savagely torn to pieces. The cot had been slashed apart, and each of its wooden legs had been broken. Klaus's few possessions, which he had kept in a cardboard box, were scattered over the floor. The oil lantern had been smashed, as well as the naked overhead light bulb. Klaus's clothing had been cut apart, searched, and flung down. They had reasoned better than Carlos had anticipated. They had expected to find the papers here. It was necessary for him to move quickly and surely now, but Carlos felt paralyzed and without strength. Klaus stared at him through half-open eyes. Carlos said,
"Klaus, it would have worked out if you had been careful and stayed sober. $500 for you." "Klaus, you idiot. I was going to take you to my farm. You and me and Anna. The farm was worth more than anything. More than $100,000. "Klaus, you fool!"
He cursed the dead man until he couldn't think of any more curses. Then he tried to close Klaus's eyes, but the eyelids wouldn't stay down. After that, with considerable embarrassment, Carlos mumbled a prayer over the corpse. He wasn't a religious man himself. He knew all that sort of thing was nonsense, but perhaps Klaus had been a believer. He wiped his hands on his pants, looked around the room again, and went to the shattered light bulb. Gently he unscrewed it. Inside, folded into the socket, were the secrets he had copied onto onion skin paper. He had burned the originals days ago. Those men had searched well, but they had not looked behind a broken light bulb. He found another bulb under Klaus's bed, put the papers back in the socket, and screwed in the bulb as far as it would go. It wouldn't light, of course, and now there was no Klaus to guard it. But he had no other place to put the papers, and he didn't dare carry them on his person. With luck, they wouldn't be found for a few days more. They were his final hope if everything else went wrong. He wiped his hands again and looked sadly at Klaus. The Austrian police would probably blame him for this. It had been clever of the Russians to use a knife. He had to go to Anna at once. But if they had known where to find Klaus, they must also know where Anna lived. Klaus had visited Anna several times. He must have been followed. Therefore, it was impossible to go to her. She would have to do as well as she could. Now, right now, was the time for him to leave for the nearest border. He cursed himself for an idiot because he knew he couldn't do that. What would they do to her? He couldn't just leave that placid blonde woman to take whatever happened. Even though the world was full of women, this one had become a part of his dream, part of his life. He hadn't been able to help Klaus, who had died because of him. He had to try to help Anna. He knew as he left the cellar that he had doomed himself, but he refused to think about it. He would get Anna out of the room. They would leave Vienna separately. They would meet in Turkey. He could still do it. They hadn't killed him yet. End of chapter 24. Chapter 25 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 25. Anna sat alone in the hotel room with an unread fashion magazine on her knees, staring vacantly at a discolored blotch on the wall. Carlos had been gone for nearly 3 hours, and fear had taken his place. Fear, the exact shape and size of a small black-haired man, crept around the narrow room showing its new wounds and begging for Christian burial. Fear proved the folly of resisting a world which killed the presumptuous. She had known it. She had told him so. But men never listened. She had known the end from its beginning, and she had been determined to stay as she had always been, uninvolved, passive, uncaring. There was safety in that posture of the mind, laboriously learned, cunningly preserved in spite of all the rages and passions of men. She had kept herself for herself. Implicit in her amiable, dull-surfaced passivity was the hidden resistance of meager emotional equipment kept carefully detached, a jewel of high value only to herself. But now fear had crept under the door to take Carlos's place, and the shadow of death had stroked her with cold fingers, lain beside her in the bed, stripped away her defenses like so many articles of clothing which outlined what they were meant to conceal. Life had produced a wound in her soul which had mercifully scabbed over, and death, the fine surgeon, had picked the scab away. Now, much too late, she was helplessly and terribly in love with a foreigner who thought he could match his wits and his turbulent vitality against a world which endlessly swallowed the energy and dreams of men. Like all good things, love had come too late. But even now, waiting for word of Carlos's death, she could not regret her sudden vulnerability. She promised herself that she would never regret it. And then, disconcertingly, Carlos was in the room, as suddenly as a jack-in-the-box, grinning, peering around, coming quickly to the bed and pulling her to her feet.
"Listen to me, Anna. This is important. You must leave this room at once. You must go to Istanbul and wait for me."
"Istanbul? Why Istanbul?"
"I've been there on the ship. It's a good city."
"What happened?"
"That drunk Klaus is dead. Nothing else. You must leave at once."
"With you?"
"No, it's safer if we go separately. I still have some business here."
She understood what he meant and pulled him fiercely to her. She could not deny herself a moment of loving Carlos in the flesh before the long, weary years of loving him as a memory. She felt his hard body pressed against her, his forehead against her cheek. Then violently, he pushed her away.
"Anna, stop this foolishness. Get out of here at once."
She walked slowly to the door.
"Will we have the farm in Australia?"
"Of course."
"And where will we meet in Istanbul?"
"At the American Express. I don't know where it is, but you can ask someone. We'll meet in front of it at noon."
"On what day?"
"Any day."
She reached the door, opened it, and stepped into the hall. Then Carlos, moving noiselessly behind her, touched her on the shoulder. As he did, she also heard the tread of footsteps on the floor below.
"Go to the next landing," Carlos said. "I don't think they'll bother looking for you. In an hour you can come down and leave for Istanbul."
"Carlos, isn't there some way?"
He shoved her roughly toward the stairs, his face suddenly enraged.
"Get upstairs," he whispered. "If there was another way, don't you think I'd take it? I'll meet you in Istanbul. Don't forget."
She nodded and hurried up the stairs. The last thing she could do for him now was to leave him alone. She ran up 5 flights, all the way to the top of the building, in order not to hear what was happening below. End of chapter 25. Chapter 26 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 26. Susan Bellows stood in front of a liquor store, pretending to be engrossed in its window display. In the dusty glass, she could see the reflection of the building into which the thief had gone. A man stood beside her, prettily handsome in a beige linen suit and perforated yellow shoes. He also was pretending to look at the display, but out of the corner of his eye he was watching her. He softly cleared his throat over and over again, preparing himself to address her.
"Ahem," he said, a tentative and hopeful little sound, and he edged a step nearer.
She knew it was her own fault. She had been standing in front of this damn window for a full 15 minutes. It had given him ideas. She wondered if other lady Secret Service agents ran into this sort of difficulty. She had thought the thief must have spotted her when he went into that cellar several blocks from here. She had seriously considered leaving her post and trying to find a policeman. But she didn't know if Dane and his people wanted to mix the Austrian police in this. And what would she have said? Some melodramatic line in her vestigial German?
"Officer, arrest that man. He is an espionage agent wanted by the East and West."
They would have laughed at her. She might have pretended that he had stolen her purse, but that idea didn't occur to her until much later. The truth was, she had been afraid of making a fool of herself. Besides, Dane had not asked for help from local law enforcement agencies. Perhaps it just wasn't done. Who the hell knew what was done? She was sure of one thing. She had done a good job of following the man. When he had gone into the cellar, she had taken off her light spring coat, thus effecting a sort of disguise. It had been a good improvisation, but the thief, emerging ashen-faced 5 minutes later, had been too abstracted to notice her even if she had walked at his side. She had followed him to this building without difficulty, and now the job was almost over. He was as good as caught if Dane would only come. She glanced at her watch. It had been over half an hour since Blake had telephoned. If he had telephoned. The man in the yellow shoes smiled at her and said,
"It is annoying to be kept waiting, is it not?"
She ignored him. A big gray Mercedes sedan was pulling to the curb in front of the thief's building. She saw at once that Dane wasn't in it. Two men in dark business suits got out and went directly into the building.
"You are from America?"
asked the man in the yellow shoes. A third man remained behind the wheel of the Mercedes. He kept the motor running.
"I have heard," said the man in the yellow shoes, "that America is a very beautiful country."
He spoke with easy friendliness. They might have been old acquaintances meeting on the street anywhere. Attempted pickups were always like that, always grotesque. She had to remain silent. That was best. To pretend that this ingratiating old friend simply didn't exist, that no one at all was speaking. Done properly, the old friend became aware that he wasn't a fact at all, wasn't even a substance. Denied existence, he would fade away into the landscape.
"Have you been in Vienna long?"
He seemed determined to make his presence felt. His shoes squeaked aggressively. He was real. He was here. He wanted recognition. He had a life and a mind, habits and possessions. A word from her, and he would become a person. But the word was not spoken, and he walked away regretfully, merging into the background, a corporate part of the sights and sounds of Vienna. Now, as she watched through the dusty glass, the two men emerged from the building. They were supporting a third man between them, the thief, limp and unresisting, his eyes open and unfocused like the eyes of a drunk. They bundled him tenderly into the car, and she watched, furious, unable to do a thing. The door slammed shut. The car pulled smoothly away from the curb. She whirled around and glared as it drove sedately to the corner, turned right, and vanished from view. It was then too late that Dane came driving up in a little red Triumph sports car. She climbed into the bucket seat beside him.
"You just missed them, all of them. They turned right at the corner."
She was thrown back as the Triumph accelerated suddenly and swung around the corner on two wheels. 3 blocks ahead, she thought she could make out the square back of the Mercedes.
"What took you so long?"
she said. "I was taking a bath," Dane said. End of chapter 26. Chapter 27 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 27. Dane's face was calm and unreadable. He had one hand on the steering wheel, the other on the shift as they cut through city traffic. It seemed to Susan that they were traveling at a suicidal speed, but the Mercedes held its lead, even gaining half a block. They were just able to keep its square gray rear in sight. Buildings flashed by in long streaks of gray and yellow. Pedestrians, already warned by the Mercedes passage, leaped for safety. Cars moved far to the right, except for an occasional truck, solid and immovable as a roadblock, its driver looking up startled as the Triumph swept around him. In the thickest downtown traffic, the Triumph was able to gain almost 4 blocks on the less agile Mercedes, coming up less than a car's length from its rear bumper. But then they were in the outskirts of Vienna, rushing past a long factory complex. The Mercedes slowly began to pull away.
"Where does this road lead?" Susan asked.
"To the Czechoslovakian border near Stupava."
"Is there a barrier?"
"I think so, but they might be able to drive right through it."
"Isn't there anything ahead to stop them?"
Dane thought for a moment. "There's an Austrian army training camp further down, but it's only used for spring maneuvers.
I don't suppose they're holding the maneuvers now."
Not for another week."
"For God's sake! Then they might be able to cross into Czechoslovakia."
"It's entirely possible," Dane said. "I don't know what's going to happen. Susan, if we have an opportunity to stop or slow down, I want you to get out."
"Not a chance."
"I think you should. This is going to get very dangerous."
"No."
Combatants were made, not chosen, and for whatever inadequate reason, Susan Bellows had come fully into the fight. Dane concentrated on his driving. They were beyond the city limits now, going down a road lined with stunted poplars. The Mercedes was still gaining.
Dane said, "Reach into my jacket pocket. The other side." She did, and took out a long-barreled revolver. "There's a box of cartridges. Get that, too." When that was done, Dane said, "Do you think you can control the wheel? I want to try for a tire."
"I know damned well I can control the wheel."
She reached across him and took it. Dane leaned over the windshield, the revolver gripped in both hands, trying to draw a sight. The cars whipped around a gentle curve. Dane began firing, emptied the revolver, and reloaded. The Mercedes showed no signs of damage.
"How far away is the border?" Susan asked.
About 12 miles. On their left, they were passing flat fields. On the right were woods. Dane started firing again. With his fourth shot, the left rear tire of the Mercedes went flat. The car went on, but now the Triumph was beginning to gain on it. Dane reloaded, then dropped the gun on his lap and took the wheel again. They were about 20 feet from the Mercedes when the road cut sharply around a corner of the woods. As they came out of the curve, Susan saw something small and black like a billiard ball bouncing on the road in front of them. Dane saw it at the same time. He accelerated hard, trying for the extreme outer edge of the road. The grenade exploded, rocking the Triumph high on one side. They came down in a cloud of dust. When they could see the road again, the Mercedes was gone. Susan had the impression that it had simply vanished into the air. Dane drove slowly ahead. There was no sign of the Mercedes on the straight road in front of them, nor on the flat fields to their left. They looked along the woods and came to a dirt road. Tire marks showed clearly in the dust. Beyond them, tacked to a tree, an aluminum sign in German read, "Fourth Army Training Encampment. All unauthorized personnel forbidden." Susan said, "Why have they gone in here?" "Nowhere else to go," Dane told her. "If they stayed on the main road, they wouldn't have a chance. With their flat tire, I'd outrun them to the border." He looked down at the fuel gauge and frowned. "I'd have just enough gas for it. They'd never get through if the guards were ready for them."
"But where can they go from the army camp?"
"Straight across the fields into Czechoslovakia." Dane turned down the dirt road. At the end of it, they came to a high barbed wire fence. Two guards in olive drab sprawled beside the partially open gate. Dane drove in. He was on a rectangular training ground the size of a football field. On one side was a group of low buildings. On the other side were three tanks, some machine gun emplacements, and several old Buffer's cannon. A heavy fence enclosed the entire field and its installations. At the far end, they saw the Mercedes. They drove to it and saw that it was empty, parked near the barbed wire and reinforced concrete that blocked off the field from the land beyond. A sign in German warned that the land beyond this point along the Czechoslovakian border was mined.
"Then they can't go through," Susan said.
"Not that way. Looks like they're stuck here." Dane whipped the car around and headed back toward the gate. Almost immediately, another engine roared into life. A tank lurched out of the group of three, picked up speed, and headed toward the gate. At a glance, it looked like a second World War Sherman, armed with a 75-millimeter cannon. The tank was relatively slow. Dane clashed through four gears as the little car leaped forward. Then he braked and swung sharply away. The tank, traveling much the shorter distance, had reached the gate first. Unable to stop in time, the tank slammed into the gate, bringing it outward. For a moment, it was stopped dead, and Dane wondered if it had broken a tread. Then the tank backed out, and its turret began to traverse, its cannon swinging toward the rear of the retreating car. End of chapter 27. Chapter 28 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 28. Carlos lay in the heart of the tank, still drugged, watched over by the chauffeur from the Mercedes. Above, in the open turret, Zettner struggled with the unfamiliar mechanism of the cannon. Bardif sat below in the driver's seat, peering through a slit in the armor plating. In front of him, dimly red in a swirl of dust, he could see the Triumph. Giving full throttle, he went ahead to ram it. Above and behind him, he could hear the turret traversing. Zettner had figured out that much, but he still hadn't solved the problem of loading and firing the rack of shells beside him. With the Mercedes straining against a bent axle, they had driven up to the gate, catching the two guards by surprise. Zettner had shot them as they walked up to investigate. They had driven into the training camp, to the far side of the fence. Zettner had wanted to climb the fence and go across the fields, taking his chances with the mines. Bardif had said no. Even if the fields had not been mined, it was too long a distance on foot. There was nearly 10 miles to walk through flat, open country.
Dane and his quick little car could reach the Austrian frontier hours before them. Patrols in the area would be doubled and redoubled, reinforced by helicopters. Bardief saw at once that their only chance of getting through was along the main road, in a tank, which could do 30 miles an hour, which could burst through barriers erected only to stop automobiles. They would have to reach the border before the Austrian guards had been warned and anti-tank defenses set up. To do that, they had to finish off Dane. The tank, its turret open and its engine fueled, its ammunition in place for the next week's maneuvers, had seemed the perfect answer. Bardief had often ridden in tanks during the war and had watched the drivers operating the controls. He had never tried to drive one himself, of course. He was a colonel of infantry. Still, it had looked easy enough. But now, sitting behind the controls of a 30-ton machine, he was beginning to have some doubts. There seemed to be some special trick to operating these clumsy monsters. Its engine bellowing, the tank lurched from side to side as Bardief struggled with the clutching. His visibility was very poor, limited to the narrow dimensions of the slit. He was choking on the clouds of dust churned up by the treads, and he had no goggles to protect his eyes. Worst of all, his shoulder blazed with pain where Carlos had knifed him. The blade had driven deep into the muscles of his shoulder. He had hastily bound up the wound in the car, but now his exertions had torn it open again. Blood stained his jacket and dripped down his left hand. A wave of nausea passed over him when he had to use that arm. The red car was still directly ahead of him. Parallel to it, he could see the fence. The ground was broken here, and the Triumph had been forced to slow down. Even at a reduced speed, the little car leaped and bounded over the potholes like a frightened hare. Sometimes all four wheels left the ground. Going like that, Bardief thought, Dane might well break an axle. He maintained his speed, staying slightly outside the car, herding it toward the fence. Then another line of fence cut across his vision. He had maneuvered the car into a right-angle corner. He had trapped it. Bardief gritted his teeth and bore down on the accelerator. For a moment, dust and pain clouded his vision. When it had cleared, the car was directly in front of him. It had stopped, its radiator pointed into the angle of the fence. Now he could see Dane and the girl clearly, and he swore at Zettner for not getting a gun into action. He got ready to smash the Triumph into the fence. Then, as he was holding his breath for the impact, the car started to glide backwards, going in reverse away from the fence. Bardief swung the tiller over. He was too late, and a flash of red shot past the vision slit. Enraged, he gave full throttle and tiller, bearing down too hard. The tank spun around on its tread, slamming into the fence, jolting his wounded shoulder. He backed out, trying to find the car. He couldn't see it. "Zettner!" he roared. "Direct me!" Standing in the open turret, Zettner was having his own troubles. He was struggling with too much unfamiliar machinery at the same time and making a poor job of it. The operation of the turret gun was problem enough, but now Bardief also wanted directions. How was he supposed to transmit them over the thunder of the tank's engine? He looked around. At the rear of the turret, he saw an unconnected intercom, its headphones and jacks lying in a tangle of red and blue wires. He picked it up and looked for a place to insert the jacks. There didn't seem to be any place. Then he remembered that Bardief wasn't wearing earphones. There was too much to do and not nearly enough time to do it in. The Triumph was moving warily, 50 feet from them and far back on their right flank. Zettner threw down the intercom and shouted instructions into the tank. He felt it come sharply around and move toward the red car, herding it toward the far side of the fence. The woman was steering, and Dane had turned to face the tank. Zettner shouted more instructions as the Triumph zigzagged right and left, then bullets flew around the turret and ricocheted off the armor plating. Dane had opened fire with his revolver. Zettner ducked down into the turret. The tank turned, following the red car. Zettner had time to work again on the loading mechanism of the cannon. He managed to get it open. Then Bardief was shouting once more for directions. Zettner stuck his head out of the turret and saw that Dane had been leading them straight into a sand trap. He screamed a warning to Bardief as they dipped into it. The tank slewed around, its treads throwing up a shower of sand and soft dirt, refusing to take a purchase. Bardief applied more power. The treads howled, scooping out deep parallel trenches, digging into the sand like a monstrous insect trying to bury itself. Then Bardief reversed just in time, before the tank's full weight had slid into the trap. He backed away and continued chasing the car. They were coming to the far end of the fence. The car, 20 feet away, cut around sharply on two wheels. Zettner was shouting at him, but Bardief had already turned the tank. He knew suddenly and terribly that Dane had tricked him. The Triumph, with its head start and superior speed, was gunning down the length of the field toward the gate. Bardief gave full throttle, and the tank lumbered in pursuit, but he knew he could never get there before the Triumph had gone through to the main road to the border. He cursed himself for an idiot. He should have stayed near the gate and waited until Zetner had learned how to operate the cannon. 10 yards from the gate, Dane jammed on the brakes. The Triumph skidded to a stop. The heavy iron gate was sprung off its hinges where the tank had hit it, bulged back into a closed position against the fence. Dane jumped out and tried to pull it open without success. The lower part had been driven hard into the ground.
"We can still get out of here without the car," said Susan.
"We wouldn't have a chance," Dane told her, getting back into the driver's seat. "They'd drive right through that gate, and we couldn't outrun a tank."
"Not even in the woods?"
"No." The tank was coming at them again. Dane released the clutch too quickly, stalled, started again, and speeded out of the tank's way. He took a shot at Zetner, missed, and turned down the field again. Bardief could hardly believe his luck when he saw that the gate was jammed shut. He turned the tank as the red car drifted out of his field of vision. Above him, Zetner was shouting directions. He continued to turn, low buildings came into sight, passed, and he saw again the gate and the woods beyond. He had made a complete circle and still hadn't seen the Triumph. Then he realized that the car was behind him, turning with him, utilizing its greater speed and maneuverability. Enraged, Bardief slammed on the brakes and reversed. He was rewarded with a quick glimpse of the car. Then it slid away behind him, and he turned again, wincing as he used his left arm. Carlo stirred feebly. The tank lurched over a rise, and he was slammed into the steel wall. Bardief managed to save himself from the worst of the impact. His shoulder felt as though it were on fire. He knew that Dane was playing for time and winning. If the battle continued like this, in a stalemate, it could only end with the arrival of the Austrians and the ruin of everything he had planned. He tried to think of some new way to trap and destroy the elusive little car. He heard an explosion, and the tank shuddered slightly. For a moment, he thought that Dane was throwing grenades. Then he heard the slam of a breech block, the thudding of a rejected shell. Zetner had finally managed to bring the 75mm cannon into action. The stalemate was ended. The Triumph zigzagged away. When Susan looked back, she could see the black eye of the cannon winking red at her. She turned around quickly. The cannon was plowing craters near them. They reached a supply shed, and Dane cut around it so fast that Susan was almost thrown out. Dane could hear the tank's engine roaring as it came around the building after them. He circled, keeping the shed between the car and the tank, trying to think of something better to do. The tank reversed abruptly and came around the other side, but its engine and treads gave ample warning, and Dane turned the car around in time. Glancing down, he saw that the fuel gauge read close to empty. There was a reserve, of course, but he wasn't sure how much. Driving like this, they probably had another 15 minutes before they would be stalled and helpless before the pursuing tank. Then the tank changed the nature of the battle again. It charged straight into the low supply building. The pine walls barely checked it. It went right through, and the roof of the shed slid onto the tank's turret, clung a moment, and dropped off. The tank turned and charged through the next building. Without stopping, it demolished the entire row. Dane stayed on the outer edge of the tank's path of destruction. The last building went down, and Zetner's head came out again. The turret traversed. Dane had formed his plan now. He slipped into second and drove the Triumph directly toward the tank. The target was closing rapidly. Zetner fired, depressing the gun as the car moved in. Then the Triumph was racing along beside the tank, almost near enough to touch. The 75, even at its extreme depression, was not low enough to hit the car. Its shells flew harmlessly over Dane's head. Zetner shouted this down to Bardief. Bardief understood the problem immediately. He had to maintain a sufficient distance from the car so that Zetner could use the cannon. But the solution was complicated by the fact that Bardief could not see the car. And this, together with the speed and agility of the car, presented him with an almost insuperable problem of coordination. He was like a very clumsy elephant trying to crush an unusually nimble mouse. His first attempt was to drive the tank over the ruins of the buildings where the car couldn't follow, but Dane was able to dodge back and forth faster than Zetner could traverse and aim from the savagely lurching tank. Bardief came back onto the field and roared toward the fence, the Triumph moving back onto position on his flank. He swerved back and forth, hoping to shake off the car. Bardief heard the turret gun going off in rapid fire, then Zetner was shouting something at him. He turned the tank around and saw that the car had stopped. Could it be out of gas, he wondered? Could it have broken an axle over the rough field? He drove forward to ram it. Zetner was firing the turret gun, missing as the range closed. He could see Dane and the girl sitting in the car. Dane had turned to face him, and at less than 20 feet he started firing with his revolver. Zetner had been concentrating completely on the cannon, paying no attention to Dane and his revolver. A revolver had seemed such a pitiful weapon against a tank. Now he realized that he was standing upright in the turret, exposed. He tried to dive out of sight and almost made it. But as his head was going down below the armor plating, a bullet took him just to the left of the nose, smashing upward into the brain. Zetner tumbled into the interior of the tank. Bardief didn't know what was happening above and behind him. He kept on driving straight for the Triumph. The tank slammed into the car, knocked it onto its side, and rolled over it. The tank came free, and Bardief turned it left and right. He saw the girl running down the field, ignored her, and turned the tank again in search of Dane. He couldn't find him. Perhaps he was crushed under the car. Something slammed into his back. Bardief turned and found Carlos, his eyes blank and sick, grappling at him. Pain exploded in Bardief's shoulder as he threw Carlos off. The chauffeur grabbed him, but Carlos fought free, hit him in the face, and tried again to get at Bardief. Bardief hit him across the neck with his good hand. Carlos staggered back, drove his elbow into the chauffeur's belly, and leaped at Bardief. Measuring his distance, Bardief hit him solidly on the jaw, a blow with his full weight behind it. Carlos collapsed. Bardief turned back to the controls, then looked around, startled. It had grown suddenly dark inside the tank. The chauffeur was shouting something, but Bardief already knew that Dane was coming down, firing through the turret. The chauffeur screamed and fell. Bardief released the controls and pulled out his automatic. Dane was inside the tank now, moving toward him, and Bardief raised the automatic. The tank, with no one at the tiller, slammed into the fence. Bardief was thrown into the controls against his wounded shoulder. Blackness washed over his eyes, and he felt himself falling. He pointed the automatic at where he thought Dane was and pulled the trigger. He thought he heard an explosion reverberate within the tank. Then he felt the gun pulled out of his hand. He had not released the safety. His fall into the darkness became swifter, and he lost consciousness. End of chapter 28. Chapter 29 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 29. It was after sunset in Vienna when Stephen Dane, accompanied by Colonel Nestor and 4 military policemen, drove up to the building in which Klaus had been killed. The entrance to the cellar was cordoned off by Austrian security police. Dane, Nestor, and the MPs were allowed through. They went straight to the little room in which Klaus's body had been found. The body was gone now, removed after a thorough police examination, and the room had been cleaned. Nestor said,
"I think you made a mistake, Dane, to believe the word of a man like that."
"We'll see," Dane said. He walked to the middle of the room and began to unscrew the unshielded light bulb hanging by a cord from the ceiling. Nestor and the 4 MPs watched. Nestor didn't like any of this. He had a feeling of imminent disaster. He could very well appreciate the courage and resourcefulness which Dane had shown in engaging a tank with nothing but a sports car and a revolver. That had called for guts. But damn it, intelligence work also required the exercise of intelligence. And Dane, after killing Zetner and the chauffeur, after clubbing Bardief into unconsciousness, had suddenly lost his grip. The light bulb wobbled in Dane's fingers. Nestor exhaled gently when the bulb came free. He watched as Dane probed inside the socket. As he had feared and expected, Dane found nothing there.
"So you had the thief's word that the papers were here?" Nestor asked.
"That's what he said."
"And he didn't mention any other place? A safe deposit box, possibly, or a railway station locker?"
"No, he only said the papers were inside the light socket in Klaus's room." Nestor made a strenuous effort to be fair.
"Dane, I believe I can understand the difficult circumstances you were in. You say that the thief was armed when you found him inside the tank?"
"He had taken the chauffeur's gun."
"He could have shot you?"
"Of course."
"Why didn't he?"
"Because he wanted to bargain with me."
"How did he know you had the $5,000 on you?"
"He didn't. He took the chance. He also took the chance that I would shoot him."
"Why didn't you?" Nestor asked. "At least, why didn't you wound him?"
"That sort of thing isn't as easy as it sounds," Dane said, "especially if the other man has a gun on you."
"Well, do Did you have to pay him the entire amount?
He wasn't prepared to take any less, Dane said. That, at least, was true. When he had brought Carlos back to consciousness, weak and half-dazed, the thief still had his mind set inexorably on the money. With suicidal despair, he wanted $5,000 and not a cent less. In the end, Dane had believed the thief and had given over the money in return for the information. Dane had told Nestor the last part of the story. He had thought it more politic to conceal the first part under a romantic fabrication, Dane said. I still think he was telling the truth.
People like that never tell the truth, Nestor said. Do you have any idea where he is now?
None.
Do you think we have any chance of stopping him? Perhaps at a border post?
I think it's very unlikely.
Obviously, Nestor said. He tricked you. He's got those papers hidden somewhere, and he'll try to sell them again.
Dane said nothing.
But at least we have his woman, Nestor said. It won't be difficult to bring charges against her. I'll make damn sure he never sees her again. Not that it'll make much difference to a man like that.
You never can tell, Dane said. He turned to one of the MPs. Would you mind getting the janitor of this building? The MP caught Colonel Nestor's nod and left the room. He returned in a few minutes with the janitor, an unshaven old man with a sullen hangdog face. The janitor stared anxiously at Colonel Nestor's imposing uniform.
The police told me there was nothing to worry about.
There isn't, Dane said. I'd just like to ask you a few questions.
Yes, sir.
Did you clean up this room?
Of course. The police told me I could.
Did you also change the light bulb?
I beg your pardon, sir.
You unscrewed the light bulb in this room, Dane stated.
That's right.
And you found some papers inside the socket. The janitor looked bewildered.
How did you know?
Just tell me about it, Dane said.
Well, I tried to turn on the light and it didn't work. So I unscrewed the bulb and saw that Klaus had stuffed some papers into the socket. He must have been drunk when he did that. He was always doing crazy things. When I took the papers out, the bulb worked fine.
What did you do with the papers?
Were they important?
The janitor asked.
I threw them out.
Show us where, Dane said. The janitor led them to a huge garbage barrel. Dane pushed it over and knelt down beside the scattered orange peels and coffee grounds. He began to sift through them. After a moment, Colonel Nestor drew on gloves and helped. The MPs quickly joined in. They found the papers, carefully folded, stained with wine. The janitor looked at them wonderingly.
Are they really important? He asked. I don't want any trouble. I just thought that Klaus...
You can go, Dane said. The janitor hurried off with evident relief, then stopped when he heard Dane's voice calling after him. But first, I want the duplicate tracing you made. The janitor seemed to shrink. His breath rattled in his throat.
Sir, you can't believe...
Dane's voice was suddenly furious. Take this bastard to the Austrian police.
Sir, please, gentlemen.
He looked at Nestor and the four MPs. They stood around him as immobile as statues. Dane stepped forward, his face like stone. The janitor's nerve crumbled abruptly. He plunged a hand into his pocket and drew out some papers.
I must have been out of my head. I didn't know why I did it, I swear to you.
Dane examined the papers, then turned them over and looked for carbon smudges. Finding none, he gave them to Nestor. He told one of the MPs to take the janitor outside.
We'll have to search his room, Nestor said, just in case he made other tracings.
I don't think he did, Dane said. But it'll be best to search, and to keep him under surveillance for a while.
Yes, we'll do that, Nestor said. It looks as though you were right about that other man. Apparently he told you the truth.
He seemed like an honest thief, Dane said. I don't suppose you'll bother holding his woman now?
Why the hell should I? Come on, let's get out of here.
They emerged from the cellar onto the dark street. Nestor said,
The plans are invalid now, of course. Those particular bases will never be built. Not as long as there was any possibility that their location was compromised. But we had to have them back.
Of course, Dane said.
Other bases will be built somewhere else, Nestor said thoughtfully.
Dane nodded, grinning. For some reason, he seemed to find that amusing. Nestor said,
Would you bring around that girl who identified the thief? I'd like to thank her personally.
Can't do it, Dane said.
She's gone to Athens with a man named Blake. She left about half an hour ago.
What on earth for?
I believe she's interested in antiques. Nestor shook his head doubtfully.
And the thief? We still don't know his name. Did you learn it?
No.
Do you have any idea what he's going to do with the $5,000?
He did mention that he might buy a farm somewhere, Dane said. End of chapter 29. And end of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. Read by Ben Tucker.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.